From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now the fourth part in our series on the Mekong River. NPR's Michael Sullivan has been following the river from its source, high on the Tibetan Plateau, to where it empties into the South China Sea. Today, Michael heads to Cambodia. As with other countries along the lower Mekong, Cambodia has seen more than its share of conflict and crushing poverty. But in good times and bad, the Mekong has always provided, until now.
Cambodia hasn't always been among Southeast Asia's poorest nations. In fact, there was a time when the Khmer once ruled a vast and wealthy kingdom, one that covered not just Cambodia, but parts of Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand, too. Their crowning achievement, the magnificent Temple of Angkor Wat. Though this tour guide's estimate of the number of workers involved in its construction does seem a bit high.
So Angkor Wat Temple, how many people to build? 385,000 and 40,000 elephants. And 24,000 boats. Yeah.
But this much is true. At its peak, Angkor was a city of close to 1 million people at a time when London was a town of just 20,000. And water was key to the Khmer Kingdom's prosperity. Water for irrigation, for drinking, and for food from the fish that swam up the Mekong into the Tonle Sap River and lake. No Mekong, says my guide Peryok, no life.
That's why. No river, no light, and no water, no light in Cambodia.
Invading armies also came up the Mekong in an effort to conquer the Khmer Kingdom in the 12th century, a story carved in stone on the walls of Angkor's Bayon Temple.
This one about the real fighting between the Champa army and Cambodia army on the Mekong River.
Peryok says the Champa, or Cham, came up the Mekong from the south, from what's now Vietnam, and occupied Angkor for 4 years, from 1177 to 1181. The stone carvings depict the battle in vivid detail, right down to the uniforms worn by the competing armies. He points to another set of carvings on the wall that depict better times in the kingdom, floating villages, bountiful harvests, and an abundance of fish in the river and the lake.
From here, you can see the daily life of the people. Yeah. They live on the Mekong River. You can see the floating village and some business people, they're sailing on the Mekong River.
And life was very good for the people of Angkor then?
That's right.
Better than for the people of Cambodia now, Kampuchea now?
Right. Yeah, I think like this.
The floating villages still exist today. The closest on the Tonle Sap Lake, just 20 minutes from the ruins of Angkor by car, then another half hour by boat. The Tonle Sap is the largest lake in Southeast Asia, and, scientists say, the key to the biodiversity of the entire Mekong Basin, thanks to the seasonal flooding of the Mekong and the lake. Many of the floating villages are populated by ethnic Vietnamese, who just might be distant relatives of those Cham warriors who came up the Mekong to fight more than 800 years ago. These villages are almost completely self-contained, with floating sawmills, metal shops, and grocery boats, a water world where children are born, raised, and sometimes die without ever having set foot on land. Their houseboats, complete with TVs, DVD players, and karaoke machines powered by car batteries. There are even floating bars to help slake the thirst of day-tripping tourists from nearby Angkor Wat. But it's a hard life, says fisherman Do Van Thang, one made even more difficult by a dwindling catch, half, he says, what it used to be just a few years ago. His friend, Chun Van Loy, is no biologist, but he understands very well the relationship between the river, the lake, and the fish, and he smells trouble. There's more people fishing, he says, and that means fewer fish. In the past, he says, the big fish would lay their eggs in the Mekong, then the smaller fish, the fry, would find their way here, grow up here, then return to the Mekong. But with so many people fishing, he says, more fish are being caught younger, before they can lay their eggs, and he knows that's not good. If I could quit fishing now, he says, I would, but there's no other way to make money. Making enough money to survive is still a challenge for the majority in Cambodia, one of the poorest countries in Asia, a country that would probably be far better off had its recent history not included the four-year-long terror of the Maoist Khmer Rouge in the 1970s.
The court is now in session.
More than 30 years later, a reckoning of sorts in the capital, Phnom Penh, where the Mekong and Tonle Sap rivers converge. Closing arguments in November in the trial of Gengek U, the chief jailer at the infamous S-21 prison, charged with crimes against humanity. The first senior Khmer Rouge leader to be tried, Gengek U admitted his guilt and, through an interpreter, begged for forgiveness.
I still and forever wish to most respectfully and humbly apologize to the dead souls, to the survivors.
But many Cambodians haven't paid much attention to the tribunal, the majority of the population born after that dark period in the country's history. And the capital, Phnom Penh, the city the Khmer Rouge leaders once emptied of people in their bid to create an agrarian utopian state, now has more people than ever. Phnom Penh is now attracting more foreign investment and more rural Cambodians looking for work, most of it in construction. The streets of the city choked with motorcycles and the Lexuses and Cadillac Escalades of the Nouveau Riche, all jockeying for position as they pass the construction site of the Gold 42 Tower, soon to be the city's tallest. On the riverfront, giant vacuums suck sand from the bottom of the Mekong, sand being used to fill in the city's famous Bongkok Lake, the site of a new high-end business and residential complex. It's a controversial project and a sensitive one, too, which explains why hard men with guns object to my visit to the site. Land grabs like this one are the scourge of Southeast Asia, not just Cambodia. Ordinary citizens displaced by rapacious developers and corrupt government officials. Heading downriver from Phnom Penh, the scenery changes quickly. The new skyscrapers and casinos of the capital quickly giving way to banana trees, rice, and corn. The vast majority of Cambodia's 15 million people live in the countryside, and there's not much choice when it comes to earning a living. There's farming or fishing. And here, about 20 miles south of the capital, those who do fish have the same complaints as the fishermen on the Tonle Sap. 22-year-old Nguyen Quynh Thi and her husband are hauling in their second set of the day, and this one, she says, is the same as the last. Nothing, she says, giggling. It's going on noontime, but she says they'll stay out just a little bit longer, though she's not quite sure why.
Last year was better. The big fish would come down from the Tonle Sap, and we could catch enough and sell enough to pay for fuel, with a little left over for food. But every year, it seems to get a little worse.
Too many people, not enough fish. Farther downstream, just short of where the Mekong flows into neighboring Vietnam, I stopped to talk to one last fisherman. 48-year-old Kung Hut says he and his family eat fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He catches it himself and says there's still enough to go around for now, if you know where to look. But what would happen, I ask, if there are no more fish? He doesn't hesitate. It'd be an age of darkness, he says, with no trace of irony. And then he thinks about it some more and comes up with something that for him is clearly an even more horrible thought. Maybe, he says, we'll have to start eating fish from cans. Michael Sullivan, NPR News.
Tomorrow, Michael finishes his journey along the Mekong. He'll report from the last country the river runs through before it hits the South China Sea, Vietnam. We'll be right back.